Welcome to the Unconquered Podcast.
At Florida State, we won national championships and ACC championships.
Back to some basics, consistency in what we're doing. Guys get a little banged and bruised, working a bunch of different situations, making progress.
You have to have success so you know something, I can really do this.
Welcome back to the Unconquered Podcast, everybody. This is, once again, your host, Jason Staples. Picking back up where we left off on the at the end of the last episode, you'll recall that I went ahead and split this episode into two. Picking back up here, talking about Florida State recruiting, also taking some questions that were submitted via Facebook and Twitter. Once again, if you do enjoy this podcast, you can follow me on Twitter at Doc Staples. Send your questions and such there. You can also find us on the Facebook, on the interwebs at the Unconquered Podcast once again. So go ahead and give us a follow there. And of course, if you enjoy this podcast, you can also subscribe via iTunes or your podcast manager of choice. Still have to get do some work to get up on Stitcher and a couple others. But in general, we're available for subscription on your podcast manager of choice. And you can go ahead and give us effusive, give this podcast effusive, glorious 5-star ratings to push this podcast up in the rankings a little bit. Helps out quite a bit. So getting back to it, actually, one other thing that that I was part of the other part of the discussion in the first half, or I guess the last episode now, has to do with Jimbo Fisher's process approach and his long-term thinking, his long-term approach to program maintenance and such. And that actually brings up another point that I didn't get into in that episode, and that's that when Fisher brings in such a process-heavy approach and such an emphasis on doing things the right way and making sure that the culture is protected and making sure that players have to earn what they get and all of these other things, that's one way to, and this is something he's talked about in the past behind the scenes, that is a way of ensuring that the program has staying power beyond the building process. And this is one of those things that a lot of people recognize, or your better minds around college football recognize that there are a lot of coaches who are better as change agents than as maintainers. It is so much harder to maintain success than it is to create success or to bring change at the beginning rather than sustaining it throughout, you know, a multiple years. Consistency, and this is the word that, you know, it's one of those words that you hear from Fisher all the time. You gotta have consistency. It's all about consistency. Just, you know, or as it says at the beginning of this podcast, consistency in what you're doing. You gotta have that. And it takes just tremendous attention to detail, and it takes focus on process rather than results in order to get that. And that's where it's interesting to see, you know, you look at Saban and the success that he's had at Alabama for so long. And it's because of that focus on culture and focus, that pathological focus on process, and also his ability to recruit, or basically to draft while everyone else recruits. Once that program got humming, that's basically what they've been able to do. And there's a difference between that and then what happens at lots of other places. You look at, you know, Gene Chizik won one national title at Auburn. You know, you got Urban Meyer won two at Florida, and then that program fell apart. He won one at Ohio State, and they're in another playoff, so they got another chance at another one here. But the question is when do these coaches win them? Chizik won his championship right away. Bob Stoops won his championship in year two at Oklahoma. And there's a general rule of thumb that if your coach doesn't win a championship in the first 2-3 years, he's probably not going to win one at your school. I mean, that's the general rule of thumb. There are a few guys who've won them in their fourth year, but if you don't win them in your first four, then you're almost certainly not going to win a title at your school. It's very rare that you get a Bobby Bowden who's at the school for a long time and then wins a national title late in the process. But Bowden, very much like Saban, long-term guys, creating culture, running their program on the basis of doing things the right way and running a system that's going to require that guys actually walk a certain line, and that's going to require that players meet standards in order to get on the field, and that it, you know, playing time is not a birthright. Playing time is for those who've earned it. And as you build that culture into your team, and this is something that I definitely saw when I arrived at Florida State in 2000, that team was such that when you came in as a young guy, it didn't matter how talented you were because there were all those other talented guys in front of you, and you learned by watching them how to work and how to prepare and how to be professional. And that started to change a little bit, actually, after about 2001, 2002. And it changed in keeping with the downturn of the program. But that culture was so embedded in who Florida State was and what it was to be a part of the Florida State program. And I remember when Fisher was the offensive coordinator at Florida State, when he first took over, that's something he and I had conversations about that culture and how that culture had changed after 2000, after really, I mean, I would trace that back to a lot of the loss of trust that happened when Devon Darling died in Matt Drills, and there were some other factors as well with Coach Richt leaving and some other things that had, you know, obviously had some impact on the quality of coaching and what happened in terms of culture and the level of respect for coaches and trust toward coaches and all that around that time. But the thing was, when you were in that program, when I first got to Florida State, there was so much pride, not in talent, because everybody there was talented, with me as one of the rare exceptions. Everybody was talented, but the pride was in how hard these guys worked, was in the level of preparation and the professionality that everybody took into every rep. And the pride in the details, watching the defensive backs work on their footwork for an hour after 7-on-7 or after 1-on-1s and so on in the summer, watching them go and, you know, get under the pen and just work on their footwork together and critiquing each other and doing all this and killing themselves to get better. There's so much pride in that. And that's because guys didn't come in and play right away. You came in and you realized, wow, that guy in front of me is really dang good. And this is how he prepares. So now I need to prepare like this. And maybe I can be better than him. And that's the sort of thing, that's what makes a difference for programs that can last, that have staying power, is those are the programs where guys come in and there's not a sense of birthright, there's not a sense of entitlement, but a sense of the culture is such that the program is going to sustain itself because the peer pressure from the players isn't to get out of work, but it's to create that level of work ethic and attention to detail that is peer enforced. That's when you know you have a program and not just a flash in the pan good team. And I think they've had some trouble maintaining that after all of the circus that they had in 2013, 2014. Especially with some of the older guys in 2014 who just didn't work the way that they after they won in 2013, some of those guys came in fat and happy, and that set the program back in that respect some. And that's why the coaching staff had to push so hard the last couple of years to try to recreate that. And I do think that, you know, the reports within the program are such that is getting back to that. And that's where you've got to have guys like Derwin James who work like that. And I think it's going to be very, very good to have Stanford Samuels III coming in as a recruit. I mean, I played with Stanford Samuels III's father, with Junior. I played with Boosie. And the one thing that I can tell you is nobody outworked him. That guy took such great pride in his attention to detail. And you could see that in his career. He got so much better. He was a really, really good cornerback by the time he graduated because he'd worked himself back from knee injuries. He'd worked himself to being a great college cornerback. And, you know, he played as hard as anybody on every rep all year. It didn't matter whether it was in season, out of season, or whatever. And I can guarantee you that that's going to be instilled in his son. That's the kind of thing you want in your freshmen that are coming in. Levante Taylor and D-Jax and some of these other guys in the freshman class have a similar mentality. And that's the sort of thing you have to have in order to have sustained success. And that's something that Fisher has really pushed. And that's why I think he's going to be able to be one of those coaches that's going to be able to win a national title after that first couple years, after the first and initial change. He's not just going to end up a change agent, but be able to sustain a culture, to sustain a program that he built and into a period of consistency. And of course, Coach Bowden was he set the standard for what that looked like. And now Coach Saban is doing a lot of the same things. He in terms of titles has surpassed Coach Bowden, although in terms of longevity of the quality of the program, not quite to where Coach Bowden got it. But that's the way that that Fisher has decided to approach things. And I think that's ultimately going to pay off. And the talent in the program that is peaking again as they move forward into the 2017 season. In 2016 had enough talent that they should have been able to contend, and with Derwin James, they probably would be in the playoff right now. But now they're going to return those guys for next year, the majority of those guys. And again, you look at Cook and some of these guys, they set the example this year, even though Cook won't be there for next year because he's going pro, folks. Even though Cook won't be there next year, he set the standard for how to work for elite guys. And that's something that's really important for setting that program on the path to sustained success and to titles beyond that first one that Fisher got in 2013. All right, now I'm going to go ahead and move to some discussion of recruiting before we get any further. Those of you who followed me on Twitter know that I've been a little bit more optimistic than some for a while, partly because I know my history. And quite frankly, a lot of people are, it goes through cycles every year that FSU starts to hit a recruiting lull during the season and everyone starts to panic that, oh no, they're not going to land any of their targets. And, you know, this is going to be the program that ends all the momentum. And then all of a sudden they close with a flurry once the season ends and they get back on the road and they're able to make contact with these players again. And I think that's basically where we are once again. Florida State, I think, will probably finish with a top four, maybe top five, depends on a couple of decisions. Probably a top four, top five recruiting class once again. And more importantly, is going to hit the big needs in this class. And specifically, they're gonna be able to get a few guys with plus, you know, 5-star talent, some difference makers in this class here at the end of the process that take this class from being a pretty good one, from being a class that can support the outstanding classes of the last 2 years, to a really good one that actually not just supports them but adds to them. Most specifically, I do think Florida State's going to wind up getting Cam Akers, the running back out of Mississippi, who I think actually is the best running back prospect that I've seen coming out of high school since Leonard Fournette. He's one of those guys. He has the turbo button at 215 pounds. He has the turbo button and the lower body mobility and flexibility, the loose ankles and loose hips to be able to do things in traffic that not many big backs can do. And then when he's ready to go, he pushes turbo and it's over. I mean, he's got not quite Cook, but, you know, kind of like that kind of accelerator where he hits that and it's see you later. And that's on top of two backs that are as good as any class anybody else has in the country at this point, in Kalon LeBourne and Zaquandre White, both of whom are outstanding backs in their own right. But I think Akers is the best back in the country. And quite frankly, as an early enrollee, I wouldn't be surprised if Akers came in and got the majority of the carries as a true freshman, similar to what Dalvin Cook did when Dalvin Cook came in and ultimately took over when Mario Pender got hurt, took over with, as the primary ball carrier at the tail end of 2014. I think Akers could take over maybe the bulk of the carries. I mean, he wouldn't get all of them because I think you're still going to see some of the other guys, in particular Jacquez Patrick, get, you know, they'll split carries. But I wouldn't be surprised if Cam Akers wound up with the most carries of the group in 2017 once he gets on campus. As an early enrollee, he's got to figure out how to do pass protection. He's got to, you know, develop and learn and be in a position where he can do what he needs to in terms of the offense. But once he's got all that, it's next level talent. And, you know, basically replacing a Dalvin Cook with a back that's of the same kind of level prospect coming out. And boy, you talk about that as a going from great to great, or great to potentially great. That's a pretty ideal situation. Another guy that I think Florida State is going to get, I think they're going to get Joshua Kando. Both Akers and Kando moved their decision dates up. They were both going to be deciding at All-Star games. Both of them decided to move their announcement dates up a little bit. You notice that, by the way, that there's one school in common between them, and they both happen to have moved their dates up a little bit. Not actually at the request of Florida State, but I do think that Florida State's going to get both of them, and that's suddenly going to elevate that class to, should on 247 composite, it should be up around 4 or 5 once those two guys can commit. And then you're just waiting for a few others. I mean, they already have the top or the second best cornerback prospect in the country in Stanford Samuels III, who's also an early enrollee. And listen, he's another guy that is going to be able to see the field early. He's got to put some weight on, but you're looking at a kid that's going to force his way onto the field. There's going to be some battles for that cornerback role in 2017, because Samuels is going to force his way to some playing time. I don't know that he's going to be able to win a starting role, but he'll be on the field, just like what we saw from Levante Taylor and Kyle Myers this year. I think we're going to see Stanford Samuels get that kind of playing time next year. And you know, you're talking about, again, another next level talent. But other guys, I mean, they just got Trey McKitty, another early enrollee, tight end, and a kid that I hate to use this language, because, I mean, really the SEC model came from the Florida State Miami model when Florida State and Miami were dominating everybody. But, you know, this is the language everybody talks. When you look at McKitty looks like an SEC type tight end type kid, you know, from, you know, in terms of his thickness and in terms of the kind of just size on the hoof that kid has. But he's a smooth athlete and will be able to be both an inline blocker and play that H-back role. So, you know, he's going to provide some flexibility. And Fisher loves multi-tight end sets. We'll talk about that a little bit later when we get into the question and answer section of the podcast. But a huge get for Florida State, even though he's only a 3-star recruit. For Florida State and what they're wanting to do with him, that's a big deal, because he's going to be, again, as an early enrollee as well, he gives more flexibility to that offense sooner rather than later, even though next year you're looking at, you know, already having two tight ends, two junior tight ends set to go with Izzo and Saunders. Again, Fisher wants to have multiple tight ends ready to go because of the versatility of what that offers. Other guys that are still on the board, I think Florida State has as good a chance as anyone at Marvin Wilson, the number one defensive tackle in the country, to go with, I think, an underrated pair of Jalen Parks and Corey Durden. I think both of those guys are underrated, both really good athletes and not fat guys that are going to be able to create havoc on the defensive line. Though, you know, both of them are perhaps a little bit behind Wilson in terms of how quickly they'll be able to play, but If Florida State lands Wilson, that's the best defensive tackle class in the country. LSU probably the biggest competitor for Wilson, along with Texas, but FSU as good a chance as anybody there. And then I think Jerez Parks, you know, we'll see if Alabama has enough room for him. And we'll see whether or not he sees more opportunity at Florida State than at Alabama, where they've been basically drafting players rather than recruiting him. I think FSU has a good chance at him. If they get both Kando and Parks, they go from concerns at the defensive end position of being able to land a couple top guys to landing two of the top five defensive end prospects in the country. And, you know, with Kando and Parks, Kando reminds me, by the way, of Josh Sweat. He's not quite the freak athlete that Sweat was in terms of the twitchiness that Sweat had before the injury, but similar in terms of that really long frame that can carry 250, 260 without a problem, and really explosive in the lower body. Very, very natural power. I think he's raw, but he'll be able to play sooner than later. Again, an early enrollee with Kando, going to be able to come in and play both sides. I mean, he's a versatile guy, fits perfectly in what Florida State wants to do. The other big defensive end prospect that I think they may have a shot at is Trey Lawson, who I think comes down to Florida State and Louisville. He was a Tennessee commit, but Tennessee is hemorrhaging top prospects at this point, as well they should, because that program is a dumpster fire. But Lawson is more of a strong side end type, but fits really well with what Florida State likes to do in that five technique, 6'6" type kid who's going to be able to carry 260, 270, 280 and be able to play inside and out in that five technique and have some versatility up front. They'll take all three if they can get him, but we'll see what happens there. The other interesting one at this point, I think, that remains beyond those guys, and there are a couple targets that they've got, at linebacker. Levi Jones from Texas is one very interesting one. Good get, by the way, with Adonis Thomas from the JUCO ranks, former Bama kid. Fits better, I think, in Florida State, what Florida State's doing defensively than what Kirby Smart was doing at Alabama when Thomas was there. Might fit better into what Alabama's doing now than what they were doing with Kirby. It's similar defenses, but both Florida State and with Charles Kelly and with and Jimbo and with what Bama likes to do now, basically they've gotten a little bit less emphasis on size and bulk, and having a little bit more emphasis on length and coverage ability from those linebackers, and Thomas fits that bill really, really well. He is that 6'3", 6'4" type lengthy coverage type linebacker that can play inside or out. So that's another good get. But the other really interesting prospect that I'm keeping my eye on as we move forward into January is Malik Gray, who I thought was one of the best defensive back prospects in the country coming into this year. I still think he is. Some of the guys that I trusted that were at the Florida State camp last year thought that Gray was actually better than Jeffrey Okuda, who is there as well, soon to be Ohio State commit. I think Gray is one of those guys who athletically is a rare kid. He's not a Derwin James, but he's one of those guys that gives you the versatility to play him at three or four different spots in the secondary, and has next level type explosiveness and physicality at that safety position. He's a Tennessee commit at this point, but Florida State was really the other one in the decision-making process before Tennessee. And it was a bit of a surprise when he committed to Tennessee. But now with Tennessee losing so many of their top prospects and with the season that they put out, he's now scheduled an official to Florida State. And if he does wind up making that official, I think they've got as good a chance as any to flip the kid, which would give them, I think the other defensive back prospect that they need to get in this class. And I think it'll be also interesting to see whether they're able to land Henry Ruggs. I think he's the next best wide receiver on the board, for Florida State. That's really, I think Ruggs wants to go to Alabama based on everything that I've seen or heard. But it's not clear that Bama is going to have room for him. So, obviously if it comes down to FSU getting Jerez Parks or Ruggs, they'd probably prefer to get Parks because you always side with the big athlete. But depending on what happens for Bama, Ruggs would be another possible get for Florida State. And then there's Tamarion Terry, who is a big wide receiver from Georgia who didn't look like he was going to make it academically. And as it turns out, looks like he very well may make it academically, got the necessary improvements in his senior year grades and now just has to get the test score. And Florida State stayed on him. And, you know, you're looking at a kid that has high shelf talent if he makes the grade. And so that's another one it'll come down to Florida State and Auburn for him. So that's basically, you know, your recruiting in brief. I think FSU is going to wind up getting three or four major difference makers remaining in the in this class, and potentially could have as many as five or six guys that I would put in the impact category, which, you know, last year's class I only had four guys in the impact category. Levante Taylor, Landon Dickerson, and Wolfensky Aime, along with Malik Henry, who had an asterisk depending on whether or not he'd stick, and as it turns out, he did not. But this class, you know, you look at the guys in this class that they could potentially get that have that impact ability, the ability to come in and be a difference maker long term, and also have some potential impact early on. I think it's very possible that they land five of those guys. And that would be a big deal, adding that to what they've gotten in the last couple classes, because last class had fewer impact guys but a bunch of potential difference makers that needed a year or two, guys like Keith Gavin or Janarius Robinson, who it was just going to take a year or so for those guys to come in and knock off some of the rawness for them to be able to get where they needed to, and then suddenly they'd be, you know, potential All-Americans, and I think that's the next step. So you add some of this class, and the way it looks like it may wrap, it's a very positive thing for Florida State fans. So we'll go ahead and close the show then with some questions from Twitter and Facebook. First question from Warpath Radio. Do you think that from at Warpath Radio, do you think that Abdul Bello will see significant snaps for FSU in 2017, or is he more of a long-term project? I don't think anybody can answer that question at this point. I don't think even Rick Trickett could answer that question at this point, because we don't know exactly what's going to happen in terms of health, in terms of who's going to be on the roster, and, you know, what we're going to be able to see in terms of development in the spring, and that's going to say it all. I mean, I think Rod Johnson is more than likely going to go pro. If he doesn't go pro, then Abdul Bello will probably not see significant snaps for FSU in 2017. If Rod Johnson goes pro, then there's going to be an open competition for that left tackle spot, and Bello will have as good a shot as anyone at winning that spot. He came in super raw, lost a year because of the ACL, but if he develops as he could over the course of spring practice, he's as physically talented at that position as anybody Florida State has. So, you know, he could play, but we just don't know. We won't know until we start to get some reports of what's going on in spring practice. Now, move on to the next question, also from Warpath Radio. In your opinion, if FSU loses its bowl game versus Michigan, would this season still be considered a success, or does it turn to a failure? Sort of an odd question, because I don't think even if they win the bowl game against Michigan, the season should be considered a success. I think that that Jimbo Fisher and the rest of the Florida State program would consider the 2016 season by and large a failure. They came in expecting to be able to compete not only for an ACC championship, but for a playoff berth and a national championship. And they wound up with three losses, which is a failure of a season in that regard. It's an unsuccessful season for the standard that they wanted to hold to, that they should hold to at Florida State. Now, was it a disaster? No. But it was not a successful season. They managed to win a state title. They managed to keep their foot on the throat of their most important rivals in Florida and Miami. They managed to maintain some level of momentum in that regard, but you know, even if they beat Michigan, it doesn't make it a successful season. It takes it pretty close to neutral, though, if they beat Michigan. Now, if they lose to Michigan, then it just reinforces how disappointing the season was. But it doesn't change it if they lose to Michigan. If anything, if they're able to go and put a beat down on Michigan, then that establishes some momentum and again takes the sting out of the disappointment that's there from the 2016 season. All right, next question. What are Michigan's weaknesses? I'll actually deal with that, with those questions of what are Michigan's weaknesses? What do you expect FSU to do in order to exploit them? I'll handle that on a future podcast, where I'm going to focus a little bit more on those things. Next one from at SlickMick8095. With Cook likely going pro, how do you expect FSU's offense to change next season? I think depends a little bit on whether or not FSU does land Akers and has a healthy Jacquez Patrick and Akers going into next year. If they do, with Akers and Patrick and Green and Rasul, I don't know that there's going to be a whole lot of changes next year on the FSU offense. They still won't be able to run DeAndre Francois a whole lot because they don't have a whole lot behind him. You can't run your quarterback a bunch if you don't have a reliable backup. And with Malik Henry out of the way and J.J. Costantino really the only quarterback on the roster with any experience, they're not going to convert into a zone read team. I don't know that there will be a whole lot of difference, except that they'll be bigger overall at the wide receiver positions, a little more experienced across the board on the offensive line. Probably have a little bit of concern at the tackle position, the left tackle position, depending on who wins that job. But just be more consistent. I think they'll be more consistent in the passing game because of added experience and talent at the receiver position, and further development from DeAndre Francois. But they're still going to try to run the football like they did this year with Cook. They'll still try to do that with Jacquez Patrick and Akers and Rasul and Green. I don't think that's going to change a whole lot. Fisher's offense is really flexible and tends to change quite a bit depending on who's under center and depending on whether or not he's got pieces to be able to run the football like he wants. But most of those pieces are going to be the same. The quarterback piece hasn't changed or shouldn't change if something doesn't happen in the Orange Bowl. And the running back position is still going to be very strong, and they're still going to be strong up front in terms of being able to run the football with who they're returning on the offensive line. So I don't know that I expect a whole lot of significant changes, certainly not schematically, to what they're doing. I do think that with a couple of the guys that they're going to be getting back or getting on the field next year at wide receiver, you're going to see more of a vertical threat in the passing game than what you saw this year because of the continued development of Auden Tate, because of Keith Gavin getting on the field, and because of George Campbell getting healthy again. You're going to see more of a vertical threat than you saw this year, which you just didn't see much from Florida State. Partly because of the receiver position, and partly because that's an area that Francois, quite frankly, just needs to improve his accuracy, and that's something that they're going to be working on a good bit during the offseason and during the spring. Next question from Joe Linsky. Looking forward, will J.J. Costantino be able to hold on to the backup quarterback spot or be supplanted by one or both of the freshmen coming in? It's a good question. I think we can only hope that Bailey Hockman is able to supplant him as the backup quarterback in spring practice. I don't expect that, at least in terms of the depth chart, the way that that's going to work. I expect that JJ will technically hold on to the backup quarterback spot, but I have my doubts as to whether or not, if Hockman's able to come in as an early enrollee and develop a little bit. I have my doubts on whether or not something should happen to Francois. I have my doubts as to whether or not they would wind up going with JJ over Hockman, even as a true freshman. As an early enrollee, he may actually have the upper hand if he shows anything in the spring, if it came to that, to a de facto situation. If we're talking about the guy to take the garbage time snaps and things like that, then I think JJ is going to be the guy. But that's different from being the guy that would be the next starter. But again, we can only hope that one of the freshman quarterbacks would supplant him. I don't expect that Blackman would be able to supplant him, not being an early enrollee. It's just too much to try to learn a college offense, let alone Fisher's offense as a non-early enrollee freshman. Just not realistic. And Blackman has a lot of development to do. Now, long term, Blackman has the higher ceiling and the chance to really be a quality quarterback down the line. It's just going to take him a couple years. So, knock on wood that DeAndre Francois is able to stay healthy next year. All right, next question from at TCB Knoll. Backup QB spot situation. Okay, you already answered that. Does FSU need staff change? Is FSU short an ace recruiter? Couple different questions there. First of all, I do think Florida State could probably use a little bit of a staff change overall. I don't think it needs wholesale staff changes, but I don't think it would hurt to have a new face on the defensive side of the ball to continue to add a different voice, maybe have some help on that side. And I do think Florida State is probably short an ace recruiter. Yes. I think generally speaking, if you want to be an elite staff, you want to have a staff with multiple quote unquote ace recruiters. I think FSU really has one in Brewster. Now Odell Higgins has always done a great job recruiting, not just his area, but defensive linemen. He's always done a great job there. He's something of a king recruiter, if you want to use the card metaphor. Not quite an ace recruiter, but a really good one. But you know, FSU really doesn't have beyond Brewster a guy that you would look at and go, that's a national level elite ace recruiter. And FSU's been a little overly dependent on Brewster's ability to create relationships for these national kids, for out-of-state kids. And it would be better to have one more of those guys. Now, it looks like the NCAA is going to approve a 10th assistant in January, which will allow staffs around the country to hire one more assistant who will be able to be an on-field coach and recruiter. Best bet is that Florida State hires a defensive, an additional defensive coach, someone else to work with the secondary. So you can split the secondary, say, with safeties and corners. And ideally, you get a guy that's going to be an ace recruiter in that spot and also be an additional voice in terms of scheme and all that. And that would go a long way. If they're able to get an ace recruiter who can do all of that, then that would be a huge factor in terms of what they need in terms of staff change. And, you know, there are rumblings around the program and have been rumblings around the program that Bill Miller, the linebackers coach, is ultimately going to step down and that they'll end up replacing him there, which I think probably would be a good overall move for the program as well. So, you know, we'll see what happens there. But I don't think that standing totally pat is the way to go here. But I do think that given the momentum on the recruiting trail and given some of the progress that we saw defensively in terms of assignment soundness, technique soundness, and some of these other things, that the need for wholesale staff changes has been dramatically overstated by most in most of the fans and the sort of internet fan base for Florida State. Next question from Sam Steyer. What is your perception of FSU's trajectory long term following a disappointing season? How do you improve said trajectory? I think actually this season sort of represents just sort of staying flat in terms of FSU's trajectory, with really next season being the one that's going to determine where the trajectory is. I do think that given the momentum on the recruiting trail, if Florida State's able to close like it looks like they might in recruiting and finish with another top five class and pulling in a guy like Akers and a guy like Kando and some of these others, then the trajectory is still upward because the bulk of the talent on this team was sophomores and freshmen. And when your sophomores and freshmen are as good as the sophomores and freshmen on this team, and then you're able to add a few more difference makers, well, the way that you improve said trajectory is you roll over the calendar. And, you know, I think that they need to continue to build further in the culture area for this team to have some of the leadership built to demand that every player on this team work like they need to be a champion. But if they're able to do that with the talent on this team, then the trajectory really is upward. That said, if you go and you get blown out in the Orange Bowl and then you open the next year against Alabama by getting blown out, then the trajectory very quickly shifts. So I do think it's important. Generally, bowl games are less important than people give them credit to be or credit for. This is one of those games that really is important for perception. And I think it's an important game for FSU and Michigan in terms of recruiting, because Harbaugh is selling that Michigan is back as a national power. They're trying to recruit and poach a bunch of kids in the state of Florida and a lot of kids out of Florida State's backyard. And it's a key opportunity for Fisher and Florida State to come in and say, no, we're still the top dogs. We are still the one, we're still the it program. And, you know, to take some of that attention back from Jim Harbaugh. So I think the trajectory in many ways is sort of in a position where the next two games are going to have a lot to say about the perception of the Florida State program and where that trajectory is. Next question, Austin Brewster. If both were healthy, Derwin or Peppers? That's not even a difficult question. It's Derwin James, without question. And then he asks why. Well, because Derwin is the more explosive, more flexible, more dynamic athlete who is the far better safety, far better linebacker, better pass rusher. The one thing that Peppers does perhaps better is punt return. And since we haven't seen Derwin do that since high school, I'm not sure he's better at that. But Derwin is an almost certain top five pick in the NFL draft. Peppers is not that. Peppers is much stiffer. He doesn't lay the lumber the way that Derwin does, and he's not as good a coverage player as Derwin James is. So to me, that's not even a difficult question. You watch a little bit of tape of the two, and there's just it's not difficult. Next question, Austin Brewster again. Reasons why we seem to take a step forward on the offensive line with Bell and Minshew. I think a lot, so much about offensive line is just comfort level with the guy next to you and gelling. And I think with Bell in particular, the difference was that that he's more experienced and there was just a little bit better rapport between him and the guys next to him than what the true freshman had. And that's not that surprising, really. So I just think there were fewer busts, fewer communication problems. And that's one of those things, you know, you talk about communication on the offensive line. Some of the communication boils down to passing off a block. So, you know, the way that that's done on the offensive line is, you know, you may be blocking a guy and then you're guiding him over to the other guy and you bang shoulders with the other, with the other offensive lineman that lets him know that you're passing a guy off. Well, that's the sort of thing you know, sort of the rhythm of how that works with the guy that's playing next to you. And a new guy or a different guy can change that rhythm, and it can change how well you adjust to those things. And to me, it just looked like communication and just comfort up front was a little bit better. I thought Minshew was basically, I don't know that there was much of an improvement between R and Minshew. I thought that was pretty much even, but I do think there was pretty significant improvement when Bell came on the field. And again, I think that's just a junior versus versus a true freshman. Running out of time here in terms of what I want to do for this podcast, but who's leaving early? Recruiting predictions, already did recruiting predictions, and Brown's success defending Fisher in the past. I'll address the matchup between Brown and Fisher. That's Michigan's defensive coordinator and Fisher in a future podcast. Who's leaving early? I think we're going to. I mean, Dalvin Cook's gone. And I think we'll likely see Rod Johnson leave. I'm not sure anybody else leaves. Nottie has a chance of leaving, but I don't think he will. I think we'll probably see Dalvin and Rod Johnson most likely be the two. Then we get Tom in Aug, at Tom in Aug. I guess that's probably St. Augustine. You mentioned double tight end sets. Could that also be due to a lack of true fullbacks coming out of high school offenses? Not really. The reason that Fisher loves double tight end sets or two tight end sets is because of the flexibility that they offer in terms of formation and play calling and that sort of thing. when you put 12 personnel on the field and you've got tight ends who can line up in the H-back, in the slot, in the backfield, out wide, all those sorts of things, it really puts a lot of stress on the defense to be able to try to cover that, and it's a ton for the defense to prepare for. It's not that difficult for an offense to learn a new formation because there's a new place to stand, but a defense has to learn how to identify it, has to learn how to, you know, has to totally go through potentially new assignments depending on where a specific guy is standing. So it forces a lot of difficulty for a defensive coordinator to have to deal with it if you suddenly have multiple tight ends who can line up all over the field. And I think the Patriots, you know, a couple of years ago and really, you know, still even now, have demonstrated how or why that is. And Fisher absolutely loves that kind of flexibility to be able to move guys around and to put them in different spots and force defensive coordinators to accommodate to that. And with a guy like McKitty, he's getting a guy that can line up at fullback, can line up at H-back, can line up at tight end and all that. And he wants guys with more versatility to be able to do that stuff rather than just a true fullback. And you know, and he said, you know, listen, if I've got a guy that's like a Lonnie Pryor or a Chad Abram or whatever, who's better than the next guy behind him, who's better than the possible, you know, tight end, then I'll adjust my offense and I'll run more fullback stuff. But if I've got quality tight ends where I can run multiple tight end stuff, then I'm better off. So that's really where he's at. Next question, actually related. Kyle Jones asks, of the two, Who do you think sees the field first based off of high school, McKitty or Marshall? I think it's McKitty basically because he's the early enrollee and he's been playing against better competition at IMG. Marshall is a very high ceiling player, but he's a little bit more raw and certainly has been playing as a man among boys to this point in his career. But I do think Marshall has, you know, again, next level type talent. There's a reason that Alabama and Ohio State and Michigan were also recruiting the guy. I mean, he's a rare prospect in terms of size, speed, balance. Final question from Thomas Robinson. I've heard lots of fans and even some media grumble about needing changes at some assistant coaches' spots, particularly to upgrade recruiting, but there doesn't seem to be much movement on that front. Might we see some changes, or do you think Jimbo stamps pat and maybe just adds consultants and the like? I do expect there to be a change or two on the staff, in addition to the tenth assistant coach that's going to be brought in once the NCAA passes that rule allowing a tenth assistant coach. I do think we'll probably see at least one change on the staff. I think that'll be a positive. I don't think Fisher's out of touch with what needs to be done on his staff. I think there were times this year where he wasn't sure what needed to be done and that, you know, wasn't sure what levers needed to be grasped. But I think that, he'll have a good idea of what needs to be done. I do think that by and large, keeping this staff intact is probably the way to go for the most part, but a change or two wouldn't hurt. And I expect him to probably do that. And I've been told, from inside that there are some expectations of a couple changes here or there, and also probably a change or two among the immediate support staff as well, that will be worth keeping an eye on, as it will have some impact on the preparation of this Florida State team moving into 2017. So I don't think that he'll just stand pat, but I don't think we're going to see major wholesale changes either. I don't think we're going to see, you know, multiple, you know, a large number of staffers let go. All right, well, that's going to do it for us once again today. Now, before we get out of here, just a reminder, you can follow me on Twitter at Doc Staples. You can also make sure to catch the next podcast, which is going to cover more of the Michigan-Florida State matchup in the Orange Bowl. Look at a couple of recruiting updates then, as well as I expect Florida State will be landing Kando and Akers between now and then, and there will probably be a few other things to discuss at that point. Don't forget to subscribe and leave effusive 5-star ratings on iTunes. This has been the Unconquered Podcast on Seminole Sports Radio. Thanks for listening. I made this.